Welcome to the Combat Learning Podcast. I'm your host, Josh Peacock. My guest today is Les Bubka, a thoughtful karate instructor out of England and a contemporary of Ian Abernethy. Les employs a different approach to teaching karate that he calls the inverted pyramid, a way to teach minimal techniques to beginners, grow their technique base as they progress through the intermediate stages of training, but then narrow their focus again as they become advanced into the black belt grades. This leads into his very learner-centered approach to training karate, allowing his students the freedom to find out how karate techniques work for them, instead of forcing them to master a single formally correct way of doing things, which allows them to construct their own style of karate in that process. So if you're interested to learn more about how this training approach works, hit the subscribe button on your podcatcher now. So tell us a bit about you and your martial arts background first.
So I'm Les Bubka, and I was born in Poland, living in UK. Started my karate journey, joining the dojo. I guess my parents must have signed me in because I can't remember it properly. In Oyama Karate, so Shigeru Oyama, Nokdon Karate. I've been training there about a year. Then I had the accident. I dislocated my shoulder. Been in a cast for a month or so. Then I had the accident with my leg. Spent the summer in the hospital, which wasn't fun. And stopped doing the karate completely. So back to the karate. I was 17 years old. One of my friends dragged me in to my sensei's dojo, which was the offshoot of Kyokushin Karate and called Shinaido. It's very unknown stuff. It came from Russia through unknown military stuff. I really honestly never found truth about it. I'm not sure if my sensei just created it and been too humble or afraid to use it as himself as a creator of it, but I never found the source of it. I've seen similar people doing similar stuff, so I found only that our dojo was doing what we're doing, but it was very much inspired by Ashihara Karate. Mm-hmm. So that's what we do. Then we lost our dojo, and by accident, I spoke with a friend in school, which he was doing wrestling there, Greco-Romano wrestling, so Olympic wrestling. And he said, hey, why don't you come to my coach, speak with him, and maybe you can have a use of our hall. And we done that. We started training with the wrestlers, and I fell in love with wrestling. So end up since 2002 doing wrestling, become the conditioning coach in that club, bring a group of rejected students, I call them, because nobody in Krakow wanted to have a group of girls doing wrestling. So we started that, and I guess become very successful. Actually, yeah. Hoping that in near future, one of them, Veronica Zygmunt, going to be featuring UFC. She is now the MMA world champion in one of the organizations. Wow. Can't claim credit for that because I've been training with them for a long, long time. But they're doing great. And those kids from disadvantaged background, so nobody wanted to train them because they've been, let's say, difficult children. Mm-hmm. But we took then 12 of them, and I think 8 of them within 3 years become champions of Poland or being qualified as within the league, because we've got like a league. Well, you guys are super lucky that you've got wrestling in every school in state. So yeah, then I moved to UK, started training here, being kicked out from a dojo for asking too many questions and have opinions. So I decided that, well, it's time to start my own dojo. And actually, a few of the people from that dojo went with me. One became my wife and the mother of 2 children. And since 2007, I'm teaching my own stuff, and I'm heavily involved in mental health. and using karate for promoting benefits for mental health and physical health with students.
Good deal. So one of them became your wife. That's crazy. So you still teach Shinaido?
I wouldn't call it Shinaido. Well, I teach my version based on Shinaido. So
okay.
The basis is there, but I've been fortunate that my teacher, before we kind of decided to go separate ways, was always supportive of training. So I like to use that story to people have a good idea how was it. First time when I went to the dojo, my teacher told me, you know, train here, but there's 5 other schools in our perimeter. Go and train with them. See which one is best for you, and then come back and choose. So I never went at that time to the other schools, but since very early, he was always promoting, go to see my friend in jiu-jitsu, do my friend in BJJ, do a train karate there. So I've been all over the different dojos around the Europe by him, you know, expressing that need that we need to learn from other people and need to test other stuff. So I had a lot of people saying that they found a teacher who was restricting them. My teacher was always supporting till last 2 years when his kind of approach changed and started becoming very closed. And saying that, you know, now we can't do this, too many changes, too many this. So I decided that, you know, I'm following your advice from, let's say, 10 years ago when you've been promoting to stuff my way.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, we had to part it our ways. But, you know, full respect to him and everything, most of the stuff which I know from karate point of view, it's his teaching. So it just, you know, I build it up on my own idea. And I've got much more influence from wrestling, which it doesn't kind of fit and exchange with his idea of karate because he'd never done wrestling. So,
yeah, that's interesting. That's both of those things are interesting. So your instructor actually was much more open to cross training in the beginning.
Yeah.
But then he got more closed minded as time went on, which is usually the other way around. Like people kind of come from very traditional backgrounds. And then as they come into more experience with martial arts, they kind of open up a little bit. Mm. So you decided to change your teaching methodology for karate. Before we get into the solutions you've developed, could you tell us about some of the problems that you identified in karate's methodology as you used to train in karate?
Yeah, sure. So like I said, I kind of early been introduced to wrestling training. And which always was kind of frustrating for me in karate is that let's say we do techniques and then we have to wait till let's say fifth cue, so halfway through, to go and have a sparrings. Although in our school as well, we started sparrings earlier. My teacher was the opinion that we should fight as soon as possible. But it was mainly a knockdown karate, so sports karate. So there was no kind of translation between the techniques of the kata to fighting. Although we have got a Kihon kata, which are kind of a bridge between the traditional and the modern fighting. So it's like a quick kata. I don't know if you've ever seen Ashihara kata or Enshin kata.
I've seen the Kihon kata from like Taikyoku. From Shotokan. We have Kibon in Taekwondo. We have the Kibon Hyung, which is what we call it, or Pumse.
So they are still very rigid. The Kihon Katas for us, or for Ashihara Karate and Enshin Karate and all the offshoots of it, they are in fighting stance and they've got a fighting combination but put in the order of the kata. So you still got the Embusen. But it's all done with the fast and fighting stance. So there's no traditional stances. There's frozen it and stuff like that. So I've got those, but it was still not translating. And as well, I didn't like that whatever we're learning is not tested on a session. So when you go to the BJJ class, all wrestling class, you've got a subject of the training, you do that session, you do the basics, and immediately you start incorporating that in a controlled sparring. So we learned today Andrag. Mm-hmm. We're spending a 20 minutes of a partner coordination drill. Then you move in it, adding a bit of a play fight. But the main job is to use that technique within and the non-compliant situation. So people playing with it, but not working together. They try to stop each other. Mm-hmm. So I was missing that in my karate, because it was all done with compliant, and you know, the punches, the hand is kept there, and then we're working around that hand, doing 1,000 techniques, and everything works. So that was the main problem, that you know, that none of karate people are pulling the hand back, if that makes sense.
Yeah, those are some of the things, because I have a Taekwondo background, so that's one of the things that I noticed as I started to come into contact with stuff with training methodologies that weren't karate or Taekwondo or Kung Fu, because I did a little bit of that for a while too, that weren't those traditional. I started to come into contact with jujitsu and wrestling and you know, kickboxing. And I started to see, oh, okay, so things aren't quite being translated through kata. You're actually looking at what you need in a sparring match, and you're doing the basics, and then you're taking those and you're finding a way to apply those basics as soon as possible, instead of just leaving it after like one step sparring or some sort of compliant drilling exercise. It's definitely something that's is a huge problem. So you've come up with a few solutions here to kind of fix these problems. You mentioned in one of your videos the inverted pyramid. So what is the inverted pyramid for karate training?
So I suppose I'm guessing that it's same in Taekwondo. So for in our syllabus, in all syllabus, you've got the pyramids set up. So you've got a lot of techniques on the bottom. Let me just have a look on my grading syllabus. So let's say let's take the eighth cue for us. Mm-hmm. It was a stances, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 stances, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 uchis or the strikes, 1, 2, 3, 4 thrusts, 1, 2, 3, 4 kicks, 1, 2, 3, 3 throws, plus combination, plus 3 kata. And that's a lot for a person who've been training, let's say, 9 months. Mm-hmm. Because usually you've got grading every 3 months, right?
Mm-hmm.
Training twice a week for an hour and a half. So you've got about 36 hours, or let's say 40 hours, to do all those things. And as we know from the sport science, it's impossible. We should start with less and easy and mm-hmm. build it up.
Yeah.
So I got rid of everything. And as well, we've got that separation in karate, I suppose in Taekwondo as well. When you do Kihon, then you go to the katas, then you've got the sparring combinations, and then you've got the sparring. So that's the 4 elements within one training unit that you have to fit. So you've got about 10 minutes per each, plus
right.
cooldown, warm-up.
Yep.
So I wasn't happy with that, and I thought how I can make it easier for people to learn and save time. So first thing, I changed the requirements and timing. So I went with the wrestling doesn't have a gradings, mm-hmm. but I've been doing a little bit of a BJJ. Not that I can say I'm BJJ trained, but I done
right.
it for a year. And I love their approach that you are training and you assessed after a year. So I got rid of all my every 3 months, 6 months training. We've got the assessment every year. And I don't do formal gradings. I just observe people through the year and say, yep, okay, you're going now, you're getting a higher belt. When we're getting to the level about fourth Q, which is a green belt for us, I'm starting to bring in external assessors. So we've got the organization where we meet, and let's say I take 3 different teachers, and just to check on me, because, you know, if we like students and stuff, we don't noticing that we're getting biased. And this person you like more, this one you like and stuff. And there is a space for even unwillingly, you get biased and promote people and stuff like that. So I've got that people coming in and assessing my work as an instructor and saying, well, listen, this person needs to work on this and this. That's what you need to do. And so I've got that. I'm part of the World Combat Association or British Combat Association, so I can always ask Ian Abernathy and people come in and assess. So I'm in comfortable situation with this. But coming back to the pyramid, so I decided that having a Kihon and Kata separately on every session is a bit of a waste of time. So I created my Kihon is the Kata. So my grades are based on Kata. So let's say 10th Q is all the ceremonies and whatever people want to get used to it. Then after a year, we're starting with the Pinan first, which is some people's Pinan second. It's so confusing, like in karate, this stuff. Mm-hmm. And that's our Kihon. So when we do Kata, we do our Kihon. There's no other techniques. It's only what is within first Kata. Plus, then when they learn Kata, we do application alongside. So there is no, you have to learn Kata. I usually start with the application because people learn easier when they know what they're doing. So if I tell you, you know, cross your hand here, draw it down, people go thousands different approaches, you know, one gonna go this line, the other one gonna go more vertical, more horizontal. But if I say somebody grabbed you, you need to hit that elbow joint from top down and scoop it outside, so you are on the outside of the person. And usually people do exactly the same thing. Of course, we have to take the in consideration different size of every people, so it's kind of individual. I'm not fussy about techniques. I prefer them work than look pretty, which I'm often criticized when my guy is doing kata because it's not so pretty.
It's horrible. Yeah.
So for us, it's actually a diamond shape. So we're starting with the a point on the bottom, so the minimum techniques required. And then when kata grows, we're growing that amount of techniques and their difficulty. And when they're going to the black belt, so the first dan, we start narrowing again. So we start into specializations. We've got the 12 kata in a system, but after being a first dan, so the process starts actually about fifth Q. So by the fifth Q, you should know five kata, so five first pinans. Yeah. And from that, you are asked to choose your favorite one. So we specialize in one. Then you're going up, you're choosing another kata. So by the first dan, you should have three favorite kata, one of the pinans and two more advanced katas. And from that point, you start specializing in applications and kind of creating your own fighting system, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And it's getting narrower. So by the third dan, you are assessed on your knowledge of those kata application, your ideas, and how you can pull it off, plus the teaching methodology if you wish to teach. But it's not a requirement, like in some schools, that you have to teach certain amount of classes, kids and stuff. I don't do that. It just it's about your ability to train and fight, really. But
how closely connected are their specializing in a particular kata and starting to develop, you know, well, with a grouping of kata to develop their own sort of fighting style within karate? How closely connected to that is with like actually sparring or doing something alive, like in jiu-jitsu, like positional sparring or something like that?
So we've got the flow drills, and so from very beginning we're working with a partner. So I took exactly the approach from wrestling. So I teach the application for the kata section. Then we do it with the compliant partner, and then we do it with the kind of a little bit resisting partner. Then we go to a counter fighting partner, and then we go into a kind of free sparring. But it's not that, you know, I will not allow you to do anything. So it's more a form of a play. So let's say we're doing a Jodanuke and it goes to the Gedanbarai. So it's going to be a block I'm using more as an underpass and then arm drag down as a Gedanbarai. So we're going to do that with a compliant partner. Then the partner is going to start resist a little bit, try to stop you. And then maybe we can add that if you are not successful in this, they're going to add the punch to your head or whatever in slow motion. And then we put the headgear and we test it as it is.
Okay.
So kind of that's how it works. And then we progress. So the kata is getting more complicated. So people do more complicated stuff. But then they have to decide what are their key strengths. So for example, for me, I know that under stress, I've got three things that I go to. Now my three stuff, which I do nearly subconsciously. And I unfortunately tested on the party when I was 18, that one apparent came in. I joined in the MMA gym and been put in the cage as a sparring partner. That's the automatically done the same. I done the open weight division judo competition as well. And the same techniques came in. So it's just automatically. I don't think about it. I'm stressed. I'm blank out. We drop our knowledge. You know, you can do all the techniques, but under stress, you just drop down. And those three comes to me. So I'm looking for in people to work with their natural instincts. I don't want them to stick to the kata. Oh no, you need to do it like this. It depends what the nature is, you know. I like to grab and wrestle. So probably if I would be introduced to wrestling before karate, I would never try karate. because I say I like cuddles. So my natural under stress is to grab and be very close, close to people. So I build everything what I do, I build about that. But you know, people are different and we look on that individual approach. And most of my students have a background in something else. And they're usually quite high grades in like traditional jiu-jitsu or different karate and stuff like that. So I don't want them to unlearn what they do, but I want them to build on what they've got and find their own way. So the key thing which my teacher was always telling me that I have to find my own karate. I don't want to be carbon copy. And actually that brings me to the methodology that I hate: monkey see, monkey do. You know, you copy me. And then I had somebody in comments about my video said that I need to do exactly 317 times kata and kata will reveal itself to me. Well, I done more than that and it didn't. So I am the person who likes to feel stuff. So my understanding of a technique is when somebody shows me, and that's why I like wrestling and BJJ, because if you've got a problem with understanding, you just, can you show me that? Can we do that in sparring? And you've got that feeling, you know, you feel how it works. If it works, it works. If it not, it not. In karate, there is a lot of space for bullshit.
Oh, yeah. Oh yeah,
and you know I'm honest with my students when we're doing some techniques. I love doing overcomplicated non-working stuff on a street, because I'm transparent with my students, saying that you know I don't want to waste time on self-defense. There are more things to do in life. I like to enjoy my karate. I like anatomy. I like to find ways of twisting my students and see where the painful places are in the body structure. But there are completely non-practical things. I think there is space for that if you're honest with the students. And, you know, when we're doing, and I've been told that many times, you know, oh, if you put this lock and you strike, you're going to break the bones. And the simple question is to the teacher, how many bones did you break in your life?
That's a good question.
How many students you end up with having a broken arm, or how many things you do on the street? And usually is, I don't know, somebody told me. So when I teach and I do something, I say, yes, it's painful. Do I think it's going to work? No. I think when people are full of adrenaline and stuff, or being dragged or stuff, it will not work. don't go there. But it's a fun thing to understand the body motion and how the body structure works. And we can play with it. But I cannot tell you if it's going to work, if it's going to snap the arm, possibly. If there's going to be enough force, yes, that happened. You know, you fell over, you break your arm. But on purpose, I'm not so convinced it's going to work. That makes sense.
Yeah, no, that makes total sense. I used to say stuff like that too when I taught, and like, yeah, if you twist this enough, it'll just rip the whatever. And I'm like, and I never questioned if it was true or not. Like, yeah, it hurts, and yeah, it's gonna hurt you, and maybe it is possible that if you pull somebody in a straight arm bar and you forearm strike or hammer strike their elbow, maybe it is possible it breaks. But would it really? Or would it be more likely to sprain it? Or then when I started to do jujitsu, I started trying to, there weren't a lot of like taekwondo / hapkido grapples that would ever work, because what I found is there's too much room for them to wiggle around while I'm trying to put it on. So I can never quite get it on just right to even do anything like that. So if I was in a real fight, I'm not going to just slap somebody into this standing arm bar and, you know, go at it with their elbow. And then, you know, the elbow, the joints are, they roll and they, you know, so it's like they think like it's that quick, like it's an anime or a cartoon or something. Yeah. You're just going to pull their arm out straight, push their posture over, and then just bam, break their, you know, we used to do that in Kempo all the time.
Yeah.
And then I realized it's a lot more complicated than that. Joints have more range of motion than we assume. Sometimes there's more things at play. You can do things with the shoulder, so you can move your elbow, and it's just way more complicated. And which is why I found out that if you the reason why wrestling or Brazilian jiu-jitsu, they tend to be better grapplers than somebody like in hapkido, is not just because of the training methodology, but because the types of grappling they do deals with larger parts of the body. So you have more control over somebody at any given time, which is why you're more likely to get a jujitsu arm bar on somebody than like a standing arm bar, like in a hapkido arm bar, just because you have more control over the whole arm and the chest and pinning them down and isolating their movement.
Yeah, definitely.
So Matthew, one of our, I guess our mutual friend who told me about you, he mentioned that you do something to me that seemed to me like a more profound change to the traditional methodology even than inverting the pyramid, which is also significant. But that was, you try to start students off training with partners like immediately or almost immediately. Can you tell us about that?
We don't do Kihon, like I said. The punching air, I come up on the end of the method, 70s and 80s methodology. Mm-hmm. So we do 1,000 kicks in the air, 1,000 punches in the air, and with power and speed. And that's how you're destroying your joints, that's stopping that kime, stopping motion and contraction is not really good for your joints, because you're sometimes missing it overextending the joints is not good.
Yep.
And it's far better to kick the back where you've got that stopping action, that actually is something physically stopping you, not your own body. And as well, you know, for me, I always struggled with translation. Let's say the spinning back kick, that's going to be something which you're familiar with it.
Oh yeah.
I could do it in the air flawlessly, but when it comes with a partner, everything all over the place. I never could place it to be effective. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we've done 1,000 kicks, like I said, in the air. But when it comes with the distance, it was off. And then you get the people coming a step forward, stepping back. And the dynamics of the kick completely changes, because you have to do that adaptation all the time. The longer you're doing a kicks into the air, the more your body getting used to it. There is no resistance when you kick. There's no adjustment, because you are guessing that you are on the spot on, and it just doesn't work. So, and same with the being in wrestling and doing stuff with the guys, and watching them how quickly they learn with that hands on, you know, we've got the warm up when you do leg entries and entries to the takedowns with some sort of equipment or even without, but it's immediately followed by the reinforcement with a partner. Oh, first, you know, compliant and then non-compliant and sparring. And I thought that's the way to teach. That's the way to teach. You have to do it like that. And in karate, so much time is spent on mixing the air in a room. Mm-hmm. That is just a counterproductive. So when guys coming to me, my dojo, we usually starting warm up is either a pad work. Well, after the like 2 minutes warm up, when we just go general warming up, then either we go straight on the pads so they know what we're doing. And it's not necessary the boxing type or kickboxing type. We do as well limb control. And so if somebody hits you with the pad, you transfer, you do your techniques, takedowns and stuff like that. And or doing the applications with, you know, if somebody comes in first time, it is more kind of accustomed to working in pairs. Because especially when people coming from different systems or styles, they are a bit taken aback. Because it's, whoa, we're touching each other straight away. I don't know people, you know. Where's the order and standing in lines and doing each knee? We don't do that. We're going straight into a partner work. And the only part we're doing in the air is a cool down with the kata. So after all the session, on every session, I do about 15 minutes of kata. When we start with dynamic kata, keeping the, you know, when everybody's warmed up, and then gradually slowing down to stretching. So people got a nice cool down. And coming back to the training, yeah, they have to, you know, for me, even if I do unrealistic stuff, it have to be drilled with a partner. Because even if some we're doing like a very fancy joint lock, you're still learning that connection with the body. So you're learning the body mechanics, how gravity works, how the angle works, and stuff like that. So, first in, straight in, partner work, and off you go.
Hey guys, real quick before the episode continues. If you're wondering how you can supercharge your training in a way that helps you actually perform better on the mat or in the ring, I've got the perfect thing for you. I've taken the scientific concept known as transfer of learning and distilled it down into a handful of dead simple, easy to understand rules you can use to supercharge your training today. And the best part is that it almost always makes training more fun, not less. Now you don't have to spend hours and hours of drilling just to fail when your practice gets tested in sparring or competition. Instead, you can take these simple rules and transform your drills and exercises into rapid skill-building machines. Your classmates and training partners won't believe your progress. And if you're an instructor, your students will get better faster than ever and have more fun while doing it. Go to combatlearning.com/transfer to sign up to our email list and grab your transfer cheat sheet now. Plus, you'll never miss an episode and get access to exclusive tips. And just to say thanks, I'll send you my Introduction to Motor Learning for Martial Arts PDF so you can get up to speed on the powerful concepts we're discussing on this podcast. So go to combatlearning.com/transfer now to get your cheat sheet and other goodies. That's combatlearning.com/transfer, TRANSFER.
That's great. We have this problem in traditional martial arts, like this limiting belief where, you know, I used to do this too when I first started teaching, but thankfully when I started teaching on my own, I was hired for a franchise that I didn't come up in. It wasn't anything related to the Taekwondo that I originally, you know, became a black belt in. So I was hired in to be the chief instructor of a school, and I believed all of this stuff. And I would say things like, yeah, they need to do it a lot in the air first before they get on the bag or the pads because they'll develop bad habits. Mm-hmm. Which is you're going to develop bad habits by doing it in the air, actually, not the other way around. And I just, the more I watch these kids, you know, and you have to do it on the bag a certain way before you have the control to be able to do it with a partner. And just every step of the way, every part of that process, not a single proposition that I believed was true, not a single one of them. And thankfully, it was the reason why I mentioned that I got hired by myself is because I did not have some sort of master or some sort of personality that I was in some way subservient to critiquing what I was doing. So I didn't have the pressure to create cognitive dissonance and continue to make myself believe that. Now, there was a period where I was studying this stuff and I was trying to reconcile it. And so I was BSing a little bit, but it continued to erode. And I realized that in terms of something like motor control, that the specific information that you use to control targeting for a back kick, for example, you need to see the body. The body is not shaped the same as a bag. It's not the shape the same as the wall or the point that you're looking at. I used to tell the kids, you see that? Figure out a point on the wall, look at the point, and then kick at it. But see, I can't measure that. I don't know what point they're looking at. I can't tell if they kicked precisely at it or not. Neither could they. And they weren't going to tell me. There's 20 kids in class. So, you know, it was just it's so all over the place. But I realized, you know, you put some pads on the kids, put a Hogu on or put a kick shield or something and let them start working that out as soon as possible. Because working in the air, in addition to not being great on their joints, is just going to build terrible habits for how to target and how to recognize what pieces of information you should be paying attention to when you're sparring with somebody or working in some sort of live drill. And it's just funny how we come up with all these intricate rationales for why we continue to do the traditional things. But the baseline assumptions, the truth value of the things we say aren't true. So we come up with an artifice to protect these beliefs, but the base propositions aren't actually true. We don't try to actually find out if they're true or not. So they sound reasonable and they sound intelligent and articulate the way that we defend how we do kata and how we do our training methodology. But there's just, it's like a squid when it squirts out ink. What we do, we find ways to obscure things more so that we can hide behind that.
I think the problem with traditional martial art is that word traditional, because there is a lot of space of really stupid things to put in. I used to follow a lot of Kyokushin is a good way, because when Masayama passed away, there's so many different organizations, and you can, if you look what they're doing, they start coming back with, oh no, that's traditional way, you know, have a full leg straight in Zenkutsu Dachi or from leaning stance is the traditional way. But why are you going to do that? Tell me the methodology. Why are you doing this from the scientific point of view? Oh no, that's how it was done traditionally. It must be right. There's no scientific justification. I'm okay with the person like, you know, you learn, probably you do that as well. Stretching, okay. Static stretching on the beginning of a session is not good. There's your data. That's this, that's that. Okay, we're changing it. But somebody comes in and says, oh no, we have to sit 25 minutes in a split before you're going to start kicking, and two other people need to sit on your hips, so you've got a better stretch. Why? Because it's a tradition. Oh, okay, but I'm not buying it. So that's one of the problems, and that's one of the things which I highly require from my students is a critical thinking, which I've got loads of backlash from traditional martial artists, because my guys and girls need to ask questions. If you think that something I'm showing is stupid, please ask me to show you how it works. It's actually I wrote an article about it. Last year, I've been teaching on the Karate for Mental Health seminar, when we're doing every year, and we've been doing a takedown. I can't remember how it's called, but in our third pinion, we've got the turn where you put the spear hand, the hand drops down, and you do turn. So you're facing other 360 degrees.
Yeah, turn. We do the same technique in a black belt kata called Tebek.
Yeah. So I'm using that as a block knee. So I'm in a control, let's grappling position. I create space by spinning, but the Nukita hand or the spear hand goes on the knee and I turn. And the thing, it doesn't work when you're doing it stationary. So I had a lot of people on the seminar saying, oh, that doesn't work with me. And I say, it doesn't work because you're not moving. It's not dynamic. So everybody's like, well, so I usually take the biggest guy because I'm very small. I'm 5 foot with the hat on top. And we start working. And when you take that movement in, let's say pummeling. Yeah. So we start doing pummeling and we move all the time. And he don't know when I'm going to apply it. It's completely changing dynamics. So then I can pull it off because I know what I'm going to do. He doesn't know what I'm going to do. And he doesn't know, he knows what I'm going to do, but he doesn't know when I'm going to do it.
He doesn't know the timing, yeah.
So I've got the space for me to decide when I want to take them out. And it worked. But the great thing is that they ask. If they wouldn't ask, then everybody would went home without that knowledge of when it works, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, always challenge your teachers. That's how I've been told by my sensei as well, that gave me a lot of trouble on different seminars because asking why is not always welcome.
No,
as you probably know. And I
rarely welcome in traditional martial arts.
Yeah, and I like to ask questions why, and usually it ends up show me that. Please show me that. Make it work on me. Show me that. That's why I love the BJJ and wrestling, because when I say to my wrestling coach, I don't understand that. Okay, come here. I'll throw you. He throws me. Oh, yeah, that's how it works. Let's do it again. I kind of learn by being thrown around.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's... And I think a lot of people are like that. People need to... Some people are better at kind of looking what's going on and understanding intuitively, but a lot of people really just need to feel it, being thrown and throwing. And honestly, all of us, there's a point at which everybody has to do that in order to develop, because you just have to do the thing to get better at it. And it's funny about the asking questions, because sometimes even in jiu-jitsu, that becomes a taboo too. But at least in jiu-jitsu, when you have purple belts sniggering in the back and at what the instructor is teaching, it's a black belt who has lots of experience. So it's not, they usually know what they're talking about. But there's nothing particularly, when you're respectable about it, there's nothing wrong with asking in earnest, asking an instructor, hey, I don't understand why we're doing this, if we could do X, Y, Z, or if we could do this or that, because they really should have an answer for you. They should have a good answer for why it is, not just, this is just the technique that we're doing. This is just the way I like to do it.
Yeah,
and that's not a good enough answer.
That's the other thing which drives me up the wall in traditional martial arts. It is, why are we doing this? Oh, because my sensei says it, because that's the way we've always done. There's no space on that, I don't understand it. Please explain to me. And when I do something and we come to the conclusion that I don't know why we're doing it, I've got that honesty to tell my students, I don't know. That's how we've done it. Or I don't know what you're asking for. I don't understand it. But I will go and research. So I can ring Ian and say, Ian, hey, why are you doing this like this? Can you explain to me? Because let's say I've done it for X amount of years, but I cannot explain it to my students. Do you've got the other view on it? Because we get in our bubbles. So I sit in my bubble comfortably. I'm doing my stuff. But we need to take ourselves out of the bubble and look through somebody else's lenses.
Absolutely.
So I love cross-training and going with the other instructor and saying, hey, have a look on my stuff, break it down, see what I've got weaknesses in it, and let's build something better. And I find Ian in particular really good. And every time when I got chance to train with him, I love to be partner with him, because it's like being children again, I do something, I say, oh, how did you do that? Show me that. Oh, show me that, Ian, because he's a bit taller than me. Is he a bit taller? Maybe same height, but his body construction is completely different.
Yeah.
So when I met him, we had he doesn't remember that, but I should have recorded. When we met on the first seminar ever, we've been discussing the cross buttocks throw. because he's a bit bigger than me and he can pull it off from the bigger distance. And I said to him, listen, that's not going to work with my body. I need to be really close. And as well, he was doing judo way, I was doing the wrestling way. But what's great about the teachers like Ian, there was no, I'm right, you're wrong. It was just, come on, let's show me. Let's test it.
Yeah.
So we've been throwing each other and saying, oh yeah, I can see your point. Your smaller frame, that's not going to work. Yeah, just change it. Just do it your own.
Yeah. Is that the hip toss? Is that what you're talking about? The cross?
Yeah.
Okay. I know exactly what you're talking about between the judo and the wrestling way. Yeah. That would be the same thing for me. I've never been able to hip toss anyone from without just totally pulling all the space away and getting under them. I can't pull them up onto me. I can't do stuff like that. But yeah, you know, the funny thing about traditional martial arts, and you said that one of the things you hate about it is just the moniker seems to impose its own limits on it. What we consider traditional martial arts is largely a like late 19th century, early 20th century phenomenon. And everything down to the way that we warm up in karate or taekwondo is in many ways not even Asian. It's an imposition of physical culture in the West that found its way through Jiro Kano into judo and found its way into karate and into the physical, you know, the wushu culture and kung fu. And like all these, like people don't realize how much influence Western pedagogy, like very outdated Western physical education ideas have found their way into what we consider traditional karate. People was like, this is the way my sensei did it in 1895 or, you know, probably more like 1920. And what they're doing is like from something that Jigoro Kano got from, or not Jigoro Kano, but like something that Funakoshi got from Kano, and it found its way into the other karate styles, and it was actually not even Asian to begin with. And it's just, people just don't know this stuff, but it's not like we call it traditional. Like even in the sports science, they'll say, yes, the traditional approach to physical education in the West is this, and it looks exactly like what we do in karate. But it's not what they did in 1850 or 1800 or 1750. It was different.
The thing which gets me, it's I've got a lot of friends I'm not picking on Shotokan, but they are a great example because it's everywhere. Yeah. So, you know, Funakoshi himself been changing everything. Yeah. It also changed everything to fit it to new reality. But you get people from Shotokan, they will not change a thing because we would change the master's teaching. We need to preserve those teaching. And it's fine by me doing a restoration or preservation of the lineage. If somebody is, I want to be doing this way, not changing, I'm going to do exactly. It's fine. That's a legitimate historian work, and I don't have a problem with this. But I've got a problem when they tell you that you're not doing karate now because your foot is in kokutsu, that's your leaning back stance, 3.5 degree off, and you changed your kata, and it's not what we've been told. Because if you look, that's the one common thing with all the old masters. They've been changing. They've been going to different teachers, instilling stuff, and improving their own. And that's what we should do ourselves. I'm saying I'm a great thief. If I see something works, I'm immediately taking it and consider it mine.
Yeah,
I do give credit when it's from somebody. But you know, that's my job for myself to make karate mine. I need to find things which I like and works for me instead of doing, I don't know, a copy of some teacher. I don't know if you can have a rude word on here, but I've got a great story which my teacher told me would probably come from something else.
It's an adult show. Don't worry about it.
I keep it nice, but you know, there was a group of traditional students going, let's say, in kata into the kibadachi or shikudachi, so horse stance. Mm-hmm. And making a funny expression with the kind of groan. So they go, ah, all the time. And that's going through the generation. And somebody asks, hey, why are you doing this actually? And nobody says, I don't know. Master was doing like that. But what happened? Nobody asked the master, and the master had hemorrhoids. So when he was going down, it was painful for him. So yeah, he was groaning. But nobody asked the question. Nobody knew. If they asked him, he probably would be a bit embarrassed, but he would say, yeah, I've got a problem down there, so it's very uncomfortable for me. The grimace on my face just comes up because it's painful. But because nobody asked, it is now traditional to do a funny face when you go into Kibadachi. And that's how I think how the traditional stuff is being transformed and transferred to our times without asking questions.
Yeah. What I find funny is people, in the absence of historical evidence on why they do something a certain way, will come up with reasons that sound plausible, but have zero evidential basis of why you would use groan in the middle of a Kibadachi or, you know, just random, weird, silly stuff. Like, why we do this? Well, actually back then they used to, you know, whatever. And then you have to harden the diaphragm. And they can just come up with all these different things to, you know what? It might not be that at all. Like we don't know. We don't know half of what, you know, because same thing with like coming up with a fighting system out of kata. A lot of it is your own experience that you are then bringing life and you're breathing life and animating these movements with your experience, because most for the most part, people really don't know what a lot of the movements originally were for. You can see throws, you can see stuff, and there's stuff that's very common that you see across schools that they all kind of apply in a similar way. And I think that's really, you know, that's indicative, I think, of an original intent in the kata. But a lot of stuff in kata is applied very differently across instructors, and I think there's nothing wrong with that. I think, but they're crediting the kata too much, and not their own creativity and experience. You're the one that's actually bringing this meaning to the kata. The kata is like a canvas.
Yeah.
And the kata did not teach you this because you didn't gain this insight from kata. You gained it from your experience sparring and playing around with another person. And I know that's real. That's a difficult point to get across to people in that do a lot of kata-based stuff, because they want to credit kata a lot more than they want to credit their master's creativity. I get in trouble for that sometimes.
Yeah, me too. I totally agree with you. And I think that, you know, we're never going to know what the kata were for and what actual application was. A, we don't have access to evidence, like you said. B, every instructor was changing to fitting their body structure and stuff.
Yeah.
C, as you said, your experiences. So, for example, for me, most of the kata are throws. I see throws everywhere. And I know I'm biased. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, we do a kata. No, that's a throw. But I'm going to compare it to Ian, because Ian's approach is more striking. Ian Abernathy. So when we look on the kata, the same thing, and we exchange our opinions on it, he sees limbs control and striking. I see, that's takedown, that's a throw. And there's nothing wrong, because our experiences, like you said, shape us.
Yeah.
Shape my execution of the kata. But I'm not imposing on my students, oh, that have to be a throw. So it is important for me to have a broader knowledge and that cross-checking with other instructors, because, you know, I've got some students which are not suited for throwing. They just, their motor skills are not in that way. They prefer to stay away and punch and kick. And I need to have solution to that, teach to them. You see what I mean? I cannot impose on everybody, we are a throwing system now, because I like throwing. I like joint locks. I like to do, we're going to be now doing like jujitsu. So I need to have that kind of flexibility of teaching different people and bringing the best of them. But I don't think so. We're ever going to know what the kata is. And I think that's what important stuff is, the education that researchers doing, like Patrick McCarthy, Andreas Quast, you know, they digging in there, finding evidence, translating stuff, and we can see. And as well, on your point on the sports methodology and that karate is using the traditional methodology, I often use the, which I'm getting in trouble with, I see karate as 50s boxing, which never followed the scientific way.
Mm-hmm.
You look on the shapes of the fists and how mm-hmm. it holds in the 50s and positioning, it was very similar in boxing, mm-hmm. but the boxing went in the route in a similar way in the sports taekwondo. You know, they invested in sports methodology and kind of stripping everything which is not suited for a purpose of doing a competition.
Mm-hmm.
And that brought in the karate is stuck in that traditional mode, or we need to keep stuff we cannot change. Sorry. I think if we had the funding, the Olympic funding, and a one body that gives the one rules, we would see complete change and evolution. I think Kudo is quite a good example how quickly they changed mm-hmm. from Kyokushin to fighting with the hands and throws and stuff. And that is very similar to MMA. I think that's the benefit of MMA. You know, everybody put their take on fighting, and from that you know more have a different styles fighting. It's their own, created their own system of mixed martial arts, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So when they started in, the BJJ came in, dominated the floor. Now everybody knows the floor because they had to evolve to fit without that reality. So you got the MMA, I call it MMA system, when you know, everybody needs to be good in every plane of fighting.
Every range, yeah.
And yeah. Like in karate should do the same, you know, whatever it's suited your training for, you should follow that with the, you know, as much science as you can do.
Yeah, definitely. One of the things I like to say is that sports culture, although it introduces weird metas when you have specific competition rule sets, I think that it doesn't, it really doesn't matter, because you always can do different things for your private training in your dojo or your dojang. And you can always use your same karate to also compete in other adjacent modalities, such as different types of kickboxing, contact kickboxing, different types of knockdown. You know, some knockdown karate tournaments are open, so you don't have to always do your point sport karate too. So I think that having something that organizes the broad number of dojos that are in your organization, something that organizes what they train towards, keeps them more honest.
Mm-hmm.
It keeps their training honest. And so it doesn't matter if some weird things, wacky things come into play. All the boomers and the old traditionalists are going to complain about it. But at the end of the day, the training is more honest because it's tethered to a living, objective training, not training, but competitive rule set that you have to be good within that rule set in order to win. And so your training methods will organize themselves towards things that work better to that end. So you can't slip in as much nonsense into your training.
Yeah, definitely. I like to use the description of karate have got many faces,
mm-hmm.
but it is up to a student and a teacher. I've been struggling with that for a long time. I try to fit karate into what people would like to do. So I went through the stage where I transferred my club to MMA. Mm-hmm. So doing a gloves, no gis, but I didn't feel it. And people noticed that I didn't feel it. It was mm-hmm. kind of mixed match. I wanted to do karate anyway. And then I looked honestly what I want to do with my karate. Is it want to be a self-defense? Is it want to be sporting? If sporting, what rules? Because my background is in knockdown, so that I'm naturally drawn to that one. Or do I want to focus on meditation? Or do I want to focus on mental health? So I chosen the mental health and meditation. I've got a group of up to 90 years old people doing karate katas as just meditation. But you have to be honest with yourself. And students who coming in, they have to be honest with themselves. What do you want from karate? Because it can provide. There's nothing wrong with being, you know, point fighter. If that's what you want to do, focus on that. And like you said, you know, use all the data you can and practices, and then not necessarily bother with self-defense. If you're not planning on defending, you want to go and focus on sports, whatever strange rules they've got, you train for that, you know? Mm-hmm. It's same with wrestling, you know? You can't grab legs. Yeah. Nobody complains, oh, wrestling is rubbish because you can't grab legs.
Absolutely.
Everybody understands. That's the rules of the sport. That's what we do, and off you go. Judo, you cannot, you know, you throw somebody, you won. How many times you throw somebody on the street, they're going to bounce up, bounce back, and start punching you. And BJJ is a good example as well.
All kinds of weird stuff in jiu-jitsu. Yeah, yeah, all kinds of weird stuff.
So it's just having that clearly defined what you want from your training. And for both for a coach, what do you want to teach? You know, I'm not feeling comfortable teaching self-defense because maybe I've got skills to do the physical encounter, but I don't have a knowledge about broader self-protection, you know, awareness, law and stuff like that. But I refer people to other instructors. I don't have a problem saying that, listen, maybe my classes are not for you because you're looking this, but I know this guy, this guy, this guy. Go and check it out. You know, I always say to my students, I rather have a happy friend than the mediocre student who is not happy in my dojo and just comes because wants to keep me happy or for whatever reason it is.
Yeah.
So honesty is the key, I think.
Yeah, that's really good. It's refreshing too, because over here, people's like, well, they like self-defense. We're going to teach self-defense now. But what is it? It's like, okay, we're going to cut the pumse or the kata out and we're just going to do one steps, and that's self-defense training. That's not self-defense training. It's not even close to self-defense training. You're not preparing anybody for anything doing that.
Yeah, I've been guilty of using the self-defense on advertising before I kind of sat down with me and myself and go through what actually I want from my training. Because of a fear, you think that you're doing karate and people are not going to come. If you've got a clear vision, it's like with everything online as well, you know. If you know what you content you're producing, there will be people who will come, who will enjoy that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
But the problem is, if you don't believe in what you're doing, people are going to sense that.
Mm-hmm.
Especially, I'm working with autistic children and young adults. And if you just have a little bit less confidence, or you're not convinced what you're doing, they sense it straight away. So there's no space for bullshit.
Nope.
So you know, you have to be yourself, and that's a good lesson. So that's how I approach my training. I try to be as honest as I can. Sometimes it's difficult to admit to students that, you know, no, I'm actually not feeling comfortable doing this. Let's abandon that ship and do something else. So. But, you know, those who like you, like your training, like methodology, will stay.
Yeah.
Others will go, hopefully to the better ways, and they're going to be happy in training. And they're going to recommend you as well, because, you know, if people go to the other club and they've been asked, oh, why did you come here? Oh, the guy from the other club said, you know, seen me not being happy here, and he referred me to the other person. You're getting that credibility with other teachers as well, you know. Oh, he's a decent guy. He's an honest guy. And that kind of spreads around your community, I think.
Absolutely. But the thing that I've come, as I've matured as a person, and it wasn't like this in my early 20s, but I think a lot of traditional martial artists, they try to be everything to everyone because they have a lot of external pressure that makes them insecure about themselves as a martial artist and not as a practitioner of the style that they do. Mm. You might be an awesome sport karateka. You might be super good at that rule set, and you are so qualified to teach it, and you can coach people at a high level, but your marketing is schizophrenic because you think that nobody's going to come if you don't advertise self-defense and cardio fitness and the traditional, some people are really into the artistic and the aesthetic aspect or the cultural aspect of karate or taekwondo or anything like that. And you're afraid of that. And it's just not true. Your messaging will attract the right people. Now, if there's no market for that, then you won't attract anyone. But there is a market for people who want to challenge themselves and compete. And you can see this with Brazilian jiu-jitsu. There's an incredible amount of people that are just regular people that go into and start learning jiu-jitsu and then end up competing. Mm-hmm. And there's just so many, it's so strange with jiu-jitsu. A lot of them don't even come to compete, but so many more people, just regular people that start training jiu-jitsu, end up at least in one competition that might have never competed if they went to a traditional taekwondo program or a traditional karate program, even if they had a competition team. And I think that a lot of people, especially a lot of men, maybe in their 30s and 40s, they used to be wrestlers in high school and through college. They did a little this or that, and they want to get back into a combat sport. They want to challenge themselves, and then they're hoping maybe to compete again. Mm. There's a lot of those guys out there that are real competitive, but they don't have any outlet.
Yeah, and as well, it's kind of, I speak with my friend who does a BJJ in Poland, and is a coaching as well, Giucato Campo. So he's a police officer as well. So the reasoning for a man about 30 as well is we're starting dropping our testosterone.
Oh, yeah.
We kind of mellowing, mm-hmm. but that's the last stage when you're going, yeah, I actually can do. And you still got that 20-year-old living in the 40-year-old body who tells you, yes, I can do it.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, and it's a great way to people to get engaged. And, you know, I'm a fan of BJJ, their training and the physicality of it, because it's great for boosting that testosterone, especially when you're in a competitive orientated gym.
Oh, yeah.
Where you've got, and you know, that sparrings, every session it yes. just stimulates you to be a bit more not aggressive is the wrong word,
assertive maybe assertive. Active
yeah
active
yeah,
is
yeah,
a good
yeah.
one. You're not really that aggressive. I mean, you have to be kind of aggressive and within certain pockets of the yeah, role, but yeah. you're not hurting anyone.
So you know, you cannot be submissive. You have to stand for yourself if Absolutely. You want to win anything. You know, you just go there and lay down, but it's not gonna be fun for anybody, isn't it?
Yeah, I think Brazilians sometimes think that you can just lie down and do a little guard and win, but that's not how it is. The wrestlers have come in and said, no, that's not how it is. Grappling is more than guard play. I'm going to get in trouble for that. I don't actually believe that, guys. Brazilians are awesome. But I like to poke fun at everyone.
Everybody is awesome. So, you know, I went to the BJJ club and purple belts and above completely rolled me over. But mm-hmm. people kind of, let's say, beginners up to, I don't know, kind of 2-3 years of experience, it was equal. But I was better in a stand-up, you know, mm-hmm. before we went down. And I would say, maybe it's just maybe because it was a small club, there was just within our group, I cannot say that it was for wider audience, but I was feeling more comfortable in escapes. So they had a trouble with it applying locks. The wrestling's got that, you know, that you have to stand up. Mm-hmm. It's got a lot of escapes from being on the ground. So I kind of naturally wiggly managed to get out from the many joint locks and stuff like that, which didn't work, which was frustrating for the BJJ guys because, you know, hey, it works on everybody else. Why I cannot do it on you? But then in other things, I was just like a baby, you know, just like a baby. Yep. That's the same. That's what I love about taking yourself out of the comfort zone. So when I walked into the wrestling gym, I thought, yeah, I'm a karateka. I'm going to keep them at distance. It's going to be fine. And then high throw, and I nearly pooped my pants because it's so frightening when somebody's throwing you over and then landing yep. on you. And you, you know, you thought, you know, break falls, but not when it's.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Somebody's crashing on you and taking all the air out of you.
Yeah.
And kind of the same panicky state was when I joined in the BJJ class and had the sparring with the black belt. Because I just simply didn't know what the hell is going on.
Yeah.
You know? He was pulling me apart. And I thought, you know, yeah, I've done wrestling. It's going to be all right. But it was just, I didn't know where things came from. And it's just painful. You tap.
It's yeah. Everyone thinks they knows break falls until they get thrown.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. So I you know, we used to in Taekwondo, we have this terrible habit of mostly only doing break falls on our own, mm-hmm. and then very rarely when we do some Hapkido stuff, we'll apply them to a sort of throw. But nobody ever gets thrown live. And when I started doing jiu-jitsu and finally started doing some stand up. Oh man, you know all the things in your head to do, but you don't have the habits. And so you end up, your legs, your knees knock together, you crush your groin, your head, you don't keep your head off the ground, you don't relax at the right time or tense at the right time, and your arm is too far in or too far out when you slap the ground. Like, it's just, you know, it's like with Mike Tyson, like, you know, everybody has a plan until they get punched in the face. Yeah, it's just exactly. Like, yeah, everyone knows how to break fall until they get thrown, a judoka.
Yeah, that's the exactly same thing with the punching in the air and punching somebody. You know,
absolutely. It feels different.
Worlds. Yeah,
it feels different. And then they start moving and you're like, why isn't this working? Yeah. Well, you never learned how to punch in the context of a moving opponent. So you're missing the timing, the targeting, and the distance management aspect of it. That's just basically all of martial arts is that in terms of sparring. And you never learned any of that when you're punching in the air. So moving into wrapping up, I really enjoyed your video about how wrestling changed how you do karate. And you've kind of talked about a little bit in terms of training methodology, but how else did wrestling change the way you do karate? I know you mentioned some about how you do stances and how you approach rigidity and things like that. So can you talk to us to how being in contact with the grappling martial art actually changed how you do karate?
I don't know how it's in taekwondo. I never done like taekwondo except once when for the sparrings, and actually they beat my ass in Poland. That was a nice experience.
Olympic guys are actually, they get a lot of crap. They're actually really good at sparring.
Yeah. So the first thing in walking into the gym, the wrestling gym, the acrobatics and the strength is through the roof. The guys with their strength and what they can do with their body is just amazing. So I went there, I thought I'm kind of a fit guy, you know, I've been kicking a lot, but my spine flexibility was non-existent. Doing throws was very difficult on the beginning, and then you gradually get that flexibility and strength, and you can pull throws and actually punches and stuff from weird angles that I never expected that it's gonna be efficient. Yeah. And the things would change, you know, in karate we've been told, you know, keep your spine straight, keep your chin up so everybody can punch it, and then and then work with that. Yeah. In wrestling, everything is very flexible. So I when I teach now, I always say relax your spine. You've got way more mobility in the spine, and that gives you allowance for avoiding punches, so the head bobbing and moving your shoulders give you better entry to all the techniques in if you're in a grappling situation, and then you can manipulate people better because you've got the strength. So we incorporated as well a lot of exercises from wrestling as a warm-up. When I've got mats, we always do, you know, breakfalls and rolls and standing on their hands and all sorts of things they do. So that was one thing. I noticed that most of my blocks in karate blocks are used in wrestling as a limb control or accessing the trunk. So the Jodanuke is underpass for me. We call it diver. So you're going under an armpit and going to the lock to grab the back and take down. So that's changed completely. The blocks for me no more existed in the I strike somebody's hands. It is all manipulation of the other limbs or other bodily parts. What else? The thinking, looking on the movement, you know, like I say, I see froze everywhere. every kata is just froze. It froze. So it kind of impacted me. Because I like it, I probably, that's kind of with me, like I said, under pressure, I'm going to grabs and throws naturally. So it's very fitting with me to grab and be close to the people. So my karate changed from being a clumsy distance fighter to be, let's say, competent, maybe is the right word, competent stand-up grappler. Within the karate realms, you know,
so more of like a clinch fighter almost.
Yeah. So I like that distance, you know, I can cover myself. I'm small, so I can run around people, and with that spine flexibility I can hide and use somebody's body as a shield, if that makes sense. And the teaching methodology, you know, and relaxation, you know. So we're not doing my dojo is not a typical karate dojo. We are very relaxed. We drink whenever we need it, and it's not that no drinking in the class. You need to be tough. You need to overthink. You need to drink. You go and drink. I don't want you to be dehydrated and
right.
and damaging your health. We chat. We laugh. So it's very relaxed atmosphere. Mm-hmm. We only do a ceremony because I like it.
Yeah.
There's no kind of religious meaning to it or stuff. Mm-hmm. And it's just nice to sit down and think that, you know, I need to focus on what I'm going now, leave my problems behind. And meditation and ceremony does that for me and mm-hmm. for my students. And as well, we're not attached to the gi. So many of my students prefer to train in t-shirts, and that's fine. I think that's the main key points.
Very cool. Yeah. You know, ritual is still important just because we don't, when we talk about attacking tradition, we're not attacking all the trappings of tradition. We're attacking like poor training methods mostly.
Yeah.
Or just really like, you know, the rigidity of class, like karate back in the day was not that rigid. It only got rigid after like, military mass yeah. teaching instruction techniques methods got matriculated down into martial arts. I mean, in Taekwondo, for example, a lot of what we do is funny because people think, you know, Taekwondo is a 2,000-year-old martial arts. Not, it's like 60 years old.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, these are ancient practices that we do. Actually, no, General Chui trained with the U.S. Army. And a lot of what we do when we line up and stuff like that is based on those military protocols. So, sorry, guys. I'm sorry I burst all your bubble about the ancient tradition of Taekwondo and karate and all that kind of stuff. Post-war. Karate was totally changed post-war. And Taekwondo is a post-war phenomenon as well. Because, you know, it emerged around the 1955 and 1960s.
It's based on Shotokan, isn't it? That's my belief.
Yes. Yeah. Mostly. So Shotokan was the main material. There's some Northern Chinese martial arts influence that you see in Changmu Kwan, and Mudok Kwan. But it's mostly, here's the interesting thing. Most people don't know this. Do you know Bogu karate? Have you heard of that before?
No.
It's like it's more of an Okinawan thing. It is people who train with a bogu from kendo.
The bogu, yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry, I thought you meant the system name, but no, I know
bogu. No, a class.
Taika Oyata used to do that a lot.
Exactly. So one of the founders of Jido Kwan trained under, one of the Kyudo Kwan. They practice full contact with bogus, and that's how we ended up with the hogu, the armor in Taekwondo. And that's why it is, instead of, because a lot of the Kwans practice sport karate with a point system and they were good at it, but we ended up developing towards the Olympic style Taekwondo that's continuous and full contact at the black belt level, because of the influence of Jido Kwan and the Koreans that trained in the full contact Bogu karate. And I believe that Oyama trained in one of those ones that some of the Taekwondo people do. Oyama knew General Choi as well. He actually came and taught some seminars to Taekwondo people. And Oyama was a Korean.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's just funny the way that Korean martial arts is viewed now, especially Taekwondo, when in fact Koreans who took karate and made their own sort of thing were actually pioneers in full contact. Mm-hmm. People think of the Japanese were pioneers in full contact, but the Koreans were right there. It's just their place in it has been obscured. But it's just really interesting how that ended up in Olympic Taekwondo through the Jido Kwan, because they trained in, most of it was Shotokan, but they trained in some of those full contact schools in Japan and Okinawa. That's a weird piece of esoteric knowledge.
From Korean styles, I really like Taekyon.
Oh, yeah.
Dancing. They do the... Yeah. unaware person of the history and stuff. I love the way they're moving. That kind of dancing stuff.
Yeah.
Type
the fluidity.
Yeah.
They become really skilled with their legs in really interesting ways. I don't think the pace is not quick enough. I don't think you could use a lot of that in like Taekwondo sparring. But it is definitely something interesting. It's fairly uniquely Korean. It's probably one of the only things that Koreans didn't fabricate after the World War II of Japan and the Japan occupation to try and bolster, because they tried to say Taekwondo is like, you know, 2000 years old and Subakdo and all that is ancient. They tried to make up a lot of stuff to mythologize their martial arts because most of it was from Japan or China.
Mm-hmm. And everybody hates Japanese, isn't it?
Everybody hates Japan. And China's, you know, people don't really mind because they use the Chinese alphabet and everything. Not the alphabet, but the calligraphy. But they didn't want to be Chinese. They wanted to be Korean. So, but even there's sources of ancient Korean martial arts, like the Subak and the whatever. And it's all Chinese, right?
Yeah.
It's all Chinese martial arts. It's like lifted from other manuals, ancient war manuals in China, and like similar, all the move, the whatever you call the Taolu or the Qing or whatever you call the forms, the quality of the movements and the way it is just obviously Chinese. The weapons are obviously Chinese, and there's a little bit of unique Korean stuff in there, but it's all Chinese martial arts from ancient Korean. They just kind of stole that from China and started to make it their own thing. But I don't know what happened to where the indigenous martial arts kind of fell off. But I know that a part of that was the Japanese occupation for a long time. Even though Koreans hated the Japanese, they only ever wanted to do Japanese martial arts after the war. So you had to teach Shotokan at that time or judo until they did that patriotic project where they created their own martial art they want to rally around for national pride. But yeah, that was a little bit of a tangent, but yeah, really, really interesting history. Where can people find you if they want to look more at your material?
Best place is lesbubka.co.uk. From that website, you can find me everywhere. But I think my surname name is unique. So if you type in the Facebook Les Bubka, I'm all over the place. Mm-hmm. Everything is on Les Bubka or Les Bubka Karate Jutsu. So my books, my work is all under that name.
Awesome. Well, your videos I enjoyed your videos. They're really interesting. You're doing a lot of interesting, cool stuff with karate. I know it's probably really late over there, so I'm going to go ahead and let you go. But I hope we can do this again sometime.
Yeah. Sure, no problem. It was pleasure to be with you. And I have to say that I did know your podcast and I listened to it quite regularly. I'm really into the scientific stuff which you provide as a great content. You've got a great content. So it was pleasure for me that you contacted me to have me on your show.
Oh, I appreciate it. Thank you for telling me that. You know, not a lot of listeners right now, but I always like to hear from those few who do listen. And yeah, dude, I love to have, I'll have anyone on the podcast that's doing and thinking interesting things. So thank you.
Thanks so much for listening to the Combat Learning Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, remember to leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts or your podcatcher of choice. It really helps us out. Finally, this episode, including the intro music, is produced by Micah Peacock. Thanks in advance, and I'll see you on the next episode. We'll be right back.